Well, welcome back to Fear or Favour, another conversation between Nazir and I. Nazir, how's your week been?
Well, you know, if I always say it's insanely busy, and this year, this week has been overly insanely busy. But it's all, I mean, I can't complain. I never complain about how good the stuff is. It just seems to be a lot of it. I wish I had more days. I wish I could clone myself.
Yes, yes. And what's taking up a lot of the time now? Obviously, new year, new projects.
Yeah, absolutely. I've taken on this role as carrying out a review of the Fire Brigade's culture, and I've started that. And that's a 12-month project, at the end of which I have to produce a report with recommendations. I've taken that on. The Catholic Church's work, the work I'm doing safeguarding there, it's growing and immensely interesting. And there's other things coming my way. Plymouth City Council have asked me to review and help them review the way women and girls are treated in Plymouth. That was, of course, following the terrible murders that took place last year by the young man who started off by killing his mother, if you remember.
Yes, yes.
And everything I do is immensely interesting, immensely satisfying. Hopefully we'll make a major difference. But as I say, there seems to be just a lot of it.
And I think the feedback we've been getting from our listeners is actually incredibly positive. They like our approach. And I think one of the things that is particularly coming through is the fact that we, which is why we've called it Fear or Favour, you know, we won't worry about pulling the punches. You know, we literally will say as it is.
As I said, the word alleged covers a lot of things. So if we say alleged, then we're not going to be liable to libel or slander. I think it's good. I mean, as I say, both of us have had careers where we've never minced our words. And I think people value that. They don't want... Now, somebody said to me the other day, Nazir, you answered the question. Yes. What's this world come to when actually somebody gets thanked for answering a question? But that's where we are now.
And made it simple as well. You know, I think you can really overcomplicate things sometimes.
Oh, too true. Yeah, we go all over the place, don't we? We're going to start this one somewhere or we'll end up somewhere different because it's a conversation. And I think people value that when they're, I don't know, on their treadmill or they're walking their dog through the park. They just want to hear people having a conversation, and you and I do that.
Absolutely. Well, I think this week is going to be a real mix. Let's start with the latest in relation to Prince Andrew. Then we can talk a little bit about the government parties, which continue to make headlines. Mm. I'd also like to talk a little bit about Djokovic. I think that that's raised an awful lot of points. And then we're going to just delve into a little bit of the crime world and look at Fred and Rose West. But let's kick off. So very recently, there's been an announcement by the Queen in relation to Prince Andrew and basically him stepping down, and he is now going to defend the case against him as a civilian.
As a private citizen, absolutely, which should have happened some time ago, to be frank. But nonetheless, it is quite a significant moment. He lost the legal argument in the New York court about relying upon the agreement that the prosecutors reached with Epstein. He has pretty much lost every technical legal argument that he's put forward, and now faces the prospect of a hearing in a New York court if this matter isn't settled prior to that. And I have no doubt the last thing Her Majesty wants is for him to be Prince Andrew, Duke of York. If he's giving evidence, it needs to be Andrew Windsor.
And this is a pretty big step for the Queen to take in relation to, you know, her offspring, to be in a position where actually you're saying you're on your own. I mean, I'm sure she's assisting him as best she can as mother, but there is a position where, of course, he is now defending and looking after himself without the support of the infrastructure and the royal family.
Absolutely. I mean, he will have his legal team. Of course, he does. And I have no doubt there are friends and allies around him. But the Queen has decided that she can't be seen to be, in effect, supporting him whilst these proceedings are taking place. And as a parent, it must be a really tough thing to do. But, you know, she recognises the public interest is such that she needs to step away and allow the proceedings to take their course.
And what an incredibly difficult position to be. You know, we're all, you know, both you and I are parents. And there'll be many parents listening to this. You know, having to put your country before your child.
I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. I have no doubt that, you know, my children are my legacy, all four of them. If any of them did something out of turn or caused some concerns, you know, would I stick by them? Well, as a parent, I would. But of course, if they've done something that's illegal, then, or potentially illegal, then, you know, I have to let the justice system take its course. That must be immensely difficult. It is immensely difficult for any parent, but for Her Majesty the Queen in the public eye, you know, probably the most photographed woman in the world, having to do this to her own son, shows you really how serious this all is.
And it's interesting following it across the media. It is not resting, is it? This is something now that, you know, there are cases in the past that have received a certain amount of media attention and then they just drop off. They just disappear. And in fact, to a degree, you could argue the first time round in relation to Prince Andrew, that is what happened. You know, he managed to disappear. This is not going away. This is now absolutely at the forefront of broadcasters, of media outlets. They literally have it under their
worldwide.
They've got the bit between their teeth now, haven't they?
You know, I was asked by the BBC in an interview recently about this, and I said, generally the media circus hangs around for a little while, as you just said a moment ago, moves away. This is not going to go away, even if this matter is settled, even if this matter does not get to trial, even whatever happens, this will rumble on, and the repercussions will rumble on for a long, long time. And, you know, as I said, the Queen is the most photographed woman in the world. She is in her 70th year as the Queen of this country. This should be a year of massive celebration for her and for the country. And it's tinged with this immense darkness, really, around what potentially Prince Andrew will have to face in a courtroom later this year.
And let's look at those options. So one of the options he has is to settle out of court. The other option, of course, is that she doesn't accept that, or he doesn't decide to make that offer, in which case he will then be subject to the process of the court, which would require him to be subject to a full detailed interview. Where do you think this is going?
To settle, as I always say, you need two to tango. Virginia Giuffre has already tweeted this week that she has no intention of doing so. She
wants her day in court.
Her day in court. She thinks it's important that the world hears what's allegedly happened to her. And so, I've no doubt that any legal advisors to the prince would be saying, we need to settle this. We need to just go away as fast as possible. But of course, you can't settle unless the other party want to settle. I think that's number one. Number two, and this may be, you know, back of my mind, when Her Majesty decided to take away royal patronages, it's probably easier for a private citizen to settle than it is for a member of the royal family to settle. I think so. A part of me was thinking, oh, is this preparation for a settlement? Anyway, we've heard from Virginia Giuffre, she doesn't want to settle. The prospect of Prince Andrew giving evidence in a New York court, I think, fills everybody, well, certainly the royal family, with dread. He doesn't have to, of course.
He can plead the fifth and decide that I'm actually not going to go and attend, and I'll let my legal team defend it.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, the danger with that is that the judgment in default is issued because he's not able to present his case and as fully as he would do otherwise. So the circus wouldn't necessarily be a full-on one were he not to be there. But of course, at some point this autumn, there will be a trial if nothing else happens in between.
It's a some big months coming up, isn't there?
For
Andrew and for everybody involved in this. This is not going away. And I think, you know, we wasn't intending to talk about this week, but it's going to rumble on. And I suspect that we're going to be talking about it on many, many more occasions as little pieces of information, you know, drip out.
Well, and Ghislaine Maxwell's sentencing hearing is scheduled very shortly. We've discussed before whether or not there's any prospect of her opening up about other matters and whether that might have an impact on Prince Andrew and others. We've got potentially an appeal by Maxwell's team. Yeah, there is a lot going on in that New York court, or those courts, and I have no doubt we'll be coming back to this subject again shortly.
And I think we have to acknowledge the respect for the US prosecutors and the US courts to pursue this, to continue with this. You know, of course, it's not an allegation. It is an allegation moment. It's not been proven. But to take on someone as powerful as Prince Andrew and the establishment, I think shows real credit to those people, because there are many countries, and I think probably the UK included in that, that would shy away from that.
We spoke about this pretty much, I think, in our first podcast, that they have no undue deference to people in public eye or public figures. They follow the evidence, and we could learn a great deal from them.
Absolutely. Right. So next, let's chat about the government. What is going on? You know, and I know your previous in relation to the trip that was done and looking to see whether you could get a private prosecution. And we've talked in detail about the Metropolitan Police's position in regards to looking at information that's come into them after the occurrence and the occasion. But we now have the Metropolitan Police saying that they are working and looking at this. Has it finally reached that tipping point where the Metropolitan Police say, we need to do something? We're losing utter confidence by the public.
Well, you know, when I looked into the Dominic Cummings, the special advisor to the Prime Minister, and his trip during the first lockdown, I didn't do so with any vindictiveness towards him. I did so because of the impact that it had on the public. The moment people became aware that he had allegedly rode a coach and horses through the COVID regulations, people said, well, why should I bother? And it had an impact in actually sort of, what's the word, making people feel safer than they were. We didn't have a vaccine at that time. People were therefore in more danger. That was the reason why I brought that action. These alleged parties, of which there are now, I've lost count,
a dozen, at least, partying nonstop.
I mean, I'm surprised they got any work done. But, you know, these alleged parties evidently happened during that same period when the rest of the country recognized its responsibility to each other. And so the question, police have said before, we've discussed before, that the police do not want to examine retrospectively because they said that at that time there weren't enough resources. The question, of course, we've asked before, well, hang on a minute, this is Downing Street. The police are there in their dozens at the time. Why didn't they do anything?
And that's the point now, isn't it? You know, there are police officers there on the occasion, and it's all well and good saying, well, we're not going to retrospectively. But at the time, you had police officers witnessing what was going on. What on earth was going on there? Was there a senior officer that said, don't do anything about this? You know, let's start hearing from some of those officers on duty. Absolutely. And let's start getting some evidence from them. And I hope that the Police Federation are onto this, and the Police Federation are supporting these police officers who at the time wanted to do something about this, to call into question senior officers in the Metropolitan Police. Because I cannot believe that there are police officers, all of them, there may be some, but I cannot believe the general police officers that were on duty in the house at that time were happy that this breach was taking place. I cannot believe that.
I agree. They would have been offended. They would have potentially wanted to do something about it. And potentially they were told not to do anything about it. And of course, that in itself, never mind COVID regulations, that in itself is a potential perverting the course of justice, which is a much more serious offence. Mm.
You know, by senior officers who must have said to them, do not do anything about this. I cannot believe officers would have just simply turned a blind eye.
And as we know, it's damaging public confidence. People, you know, whether or not people believe anything anymore is another moot point. But now people are thinking, well, there's one law for some people and there's another law for the rest of us. And that has really damaged. I mean, there's nothing else being discussed right now. And the bigger point about the police, you asked the question, would the police now, have they reached the tipping point? Do you know, I would have said that 6 months ago and they still haven't done anything about it. And of course, in their most recent missive, they said, well, the government are carrying out an inquiry, and if we became aware of any more information, then we'll take that on. Well, you know, take that to its, what they're actually saying is that if you are an alleged criminal, can you investigate yourself and provide us with your response, and then we'll have a look at it. Well, I didn't think, you know, Mark, when you were a police officer, that that's what you did.
What you do is you let the party to whom it will affect do their own investigation and then report back and tell you, actually, we've done our investigation and we don't think there's an offence. Well, hang on a minute. Of course you're not going to, because it's not going to be in your favour. What you have to have is independence. And it's casting such a concern now on the Metropolitan Police and the leadership of the Metropolitan Police. And we've said it before, and we'll say it again. You know, it is time now for the Commissioner of Metropolitan Police to step down and to get new blood in there to turn the Metropolitan Police around, because the public confidence in the biggest police force in the country is at an all-time low.
It's been shot through. And, of course, morale amongst rank-and-file police officers will have been damaged by all of this. You know, they're doing their best, they're doing their jobs day in, day out, keeping people safe, and then but then I suspect if they're on the street somewhere, they'll be approached by somebody, well, you lot don't deal with people, these rich people, you just arrest these little low-level drug dealers, it's damaging their morale too. And I go back to your point, the commissioner should have gone ages ago, and she must go.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about Djokovic. So world number one tennis player goes over to Australia, wants to play in the Australian Open, gets refused, gets held in effectively hotel arrest custody whilst he's waiting to potentially be deported. He appeals that process. And in the meantime, there is information that comes out that actually prior to coming, he did test positive. And whilst testing positive, he then ended up mixing with people, and he has come out fairly recently and said that the information he gave was not entirely accurate. We now have a position, of course, where they are wanting to send him back again. It's an utter mess, isn't it?
Totally and utterly. It's something that should have been foreseen, actually, because Djokovic has been very public about his love of homeopathy, his desire not to be vaccinated. So this is something that the Australian authorities, given that they are perpetual lockdown seemingly, would have been prepared for. So I think there's something we've said about mixed messages or whatever that's coming from the Australian authorities. But Djokovic himself, and I was taken aback by when I was thinking about it. I was thinking, had he been Serena Williams, do you think he'd have got the same sympathy? There is something here to be said about the fact we've actually talked about Prince Andrew, Boris Johnson, and Djokovic. We're talking about three white men who are relatively successful for whatever reason.
Well, right at the top of their game.
Sense of entitlement, expectation that they are, quote unquote, above the law. That's the connection between all three of the matters that we've been discussing, really. And Djokovic should have known that. That he would have been frowned upon for coming to Australia or going to Australia in the current. And of course, do we really believe that he had this? You know, somebody said that they checked the QR code on his positive test and initially didn't register, and then it subsequently registered. There's all sorts of palaver being talked about here. But at the end of the day,
Do you think there is an element of misogyny that sits around this? Because if it was a woman that was there, one of the top women players, would they be getting the support and the treatment? I mean, Djokovic has been receiving an incredible amount of support in relation to this, hasn't he?
There's no doubt in my mind, Mark. I mean, we just have to think back, actually, when the winner of the US Open, prior to winning, Emma was, I think she withdrew from a tournament in London.
Yeah, she did.
There were people saying, how grow up, she's 18 for crying out loud, what do you do? You just hit a ball, and they really, really were attacking her for that. And the same thing was said about Naomi Osaka as well.
The press conference.
So there is, of course, a misogyny element here. It goes without saying. People are happy to make excuses for Prince Andrew, Boris Johnson, and Djokovic. I don't want to put them all in the same boat, but at the moment they are. But they would never make those excuses for a woman in the same position.
Well, they're on the same boat for different reasons, but all because they have ended up not being truthful in elements of, and they've all admitted to that.
Allegedly.
Elements of allegedly. Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think Boris Johnson has come clean in relation to some of the things that he has he's now been to. Prince Andrew obviously denies all of those aspects. And Djokovic has made some admissions in relation to not being entirely truthful. But and they're all men, as you say, all white men. And I cannot see that if there was a female involved in this, and particularly, you know, a black female or something like Serena Williams, that would be, she'd be pulled over the coals.
She was. She has been in the past. I mean, she won the Australian Open pregnant, by the way. People forget how amazing she is. But whenever she said something that people didn't agree with, or they were ready to attack her, and but, you know, white men, and especially these particular white men, seem to be above it all. And there's always a ring put around them, protecting them and suggesting something different. And, we're not discussing Lewis Hamilton here, but, you know, he's another person that is attacked on a daily basis, despite his massive success, whereas some of his competitors who happen to be white males are protected from that. So there's a bit of gender, there's a bit of race, there's a bit of everything going on here. As I said, the impression one is left with is wherever you are in the world, you're going to have a different approach taken if you're a white male as opposed to anybody else.
Years and years ago, I went to Wimbledon and I was watching a game on the outside court, and there was this man next to me, big guy, and he was cheering away and he was getting really involved. I remember saying to the person I was with, "Who's that?" And he went, "Well, that's Mr. Williams. That's the boss. That's the dad." And I went, "Oh, okay." And I don't know how I didn't recognize him, but I didn't. But and I mean, I think...
I'm surprised you didn't. He probably was the only black person in the audience, I would have thought. I mean,
yeah, I don't know why I didn't recognize him.
I haven't been to Wimbledon, but I don't want to besmirch Wimbledon. It's a phenomenal tournament. But, you know, there's a certain type of person that seems to get tickets.
No, you are. I mean, I was very fortunate in my latter years to be able to go to Wimbledon on many occasions. But you are. It is. But it's class, isn't it? You know, and I think there's another issue. It's not just, you know, ethnicity, gender, but it's also class.
Absolutely.
And I think class has a massive part to play in whether or not individuals are brought before a court and whether or not individuals are believed and accepted. And certainly when you're looking in terms of Boris Johnson, you know, Prince Andrew, and to a degree, you know, Djokovic, you know, these are all people who are coming from a class background. They're not the people that have grown up through the grassroots and come through, are they?
No, absolutely. And given your point earlier on about how the Americans have less deference, they also have less deference to class. They don't really care whether, you know, what your upbringing was. If you committed a crime and the evidence is there, they'll follow it. Whereas we seem to, I remember as a prosecutor, actually, and I don't know if it's true of you, Mark, that if a case came in involving a lord or a lady, it was often taken off you and given to somebody more senior to deal with. Because, we can't leave that with Nazir, or we can't leave that with Mark. You know, obviously, the more experienced I became, the less likely that was. But, you know, there is a sense of the establishment looking after itself. And, you know, I'm not going to say that now, but there are certainly at least two occasions in my career where I absolutely know that somebody, a high-class person, however you want to describe it, got away with some serious crimes because of who they were. And that's just the nature of our system, I'm afraid.
No, I mean, over my years investigating, both in the police and in my role as an investigative reporter, you know, I've investigated some very, very high-profile individuals. And you always know that at some stage, somebody from the upper echelons of the establishment you're working in, whether that be the police or the media, is going to contact you because they will hear about that individual becoming across their radar, or somebody close to, or even the individual themselves, will reach out to somebody and say, you know, "Can you have a word? You know, I'm being accused of this. It's not true." The amount of people that have come to me, senior officers, you know, even politicians, you know, who have know this individual that the allegations against, to try and influence. There's only one reason. It is to try and influence you so that you don't partake in that.
Well, they'll always say to you, "I just need to know more about this case."
Yes. What's going to happen? What do you think's likely to happen? I just want to understand it a bit more. And it's like, you know, the amount of times I've said to senior officers, "I'm sorry, I'm not telling you. you know, I literally am not telling you. I mean, I wasn't always the most popular with senior officers simply because, you know, and the good thing about the police service is, and it's changed a bit, quite a bit now, is that you could say that. You know, I remember doing an investigation for when we had a case in Surrey where a guy was shot by Surrey police officers. And as a result of that, it was prior to the independent complaints. It always used to get farmed out to a different police force to do an investigation. And in this case, it was Hampshire that came in. The assistant chief constable was appointed to be the lead in relation to it. And I got appointed to be the Surrey representative for the Hampshire inquiry and to be the family liaison officer for the victim, the man that was shot by the police officers. And I remember doing that inquiry, and on at least three occasions, the superintendent in charge of the Surrey police end, who were dealing with obviously the shooting, we went for a coffee, and he would say to me, "So what's going on, Mark? Were you?" And he'd be prying, and I took great pleasure in saying to him, "Do you know what? I cannot tell you anything. You know, everything I have to do goes through my ACC from Hampshire. I'm seconded to them, and that is where the information comes." And I know it made him so angry; he got so frustrated by that. But
you had integrity. He made it angry. He was angry that you had integrity. Well, you know, it says something about him, I'm afraid.
No, it is that influence that comes from that. So let's talk a little bit about, so that one of these cases that's always fascinated me, and I think it's a fascination for so many people, and it's something that's come up more recently because Fred and Rose West were prosecuted in relation to multiple murders. In fact, they were believed to have committed at least 12 murders between 1967 and 1987 in Gloucestershire, all of their victims being women. And many of the offences surrounded around rape, bondage, torture, mutilation. And it was, in fact, between the two of them, that they also ended up killing their own children. It's a very fascinating aspect of how it came to fruition, because what ended up happening is that Fred West sexually assaulted his own daughter on a number of occasions, supported by Rose. She told a friend that resulted in it going to the police. The police subsequently prosecuted them, although they were acquitted. But they continued an investigation because they started to realize, where are some of these other people that had contact with them? How have they gone missing? They ended up getting a search warrant. And at the point to which they turned up at the house to execute that search warrant, Fred West said, "I've killed somebody and I want to tell you about it." And that led obviously then into the huge inquiry that resulted in digging up the area. And they did find a significant amount of victims. It's come to the fruition again last year because a television program was made around Fred and Rose West. And in fact, they were looking for other potential sites. I thought one of the very interesting things, and it's always a dilemma for a police force, is at what point do you stop looking? So they got to a point where they had got both of them charged, both going to court. Fred West killed himself before he went to trial. Rose West went to trial and was convicted in relation to 10 murders. But there are undoubtedly still victims out there who have not been found. And it's interesting. What's your thought process around? Do you think that there should never be a time to which we give up? We should keep looking?
I think you've answered my question. Yes, I don't think there should be a time. I think you need to obviously to get a trial, and you need to get people convicted if the evidence is there. So you need to identify some victims to enable you to do that. So obviously they were able to do that and move it at some pace. But that shouldn't be the end of the inquiry. And it's off going back to something we said earlier on about the circus leaving town. The media circus has left town, but the justice circus should not leave town. If you've lost your loved one, I can't begin to tell you how that must feel. You know, you've got a sense of you need justice, you need closure, you need to understand what happened to your loved one. And I think we have a duty. Surely we have a duty to ensure that they, whoever they may be, get the ability to understand what might have happened. And so there's two elements to it. One is, yes, you need to get that trial over and done with. You need to bring the case to conclusion as early as possible. For all sorts of reasons. But then that shouldn't be the end of the inquiry. You should carry on looking if there are, you know, lines of inquiry. And that's what I think has happened in West's case, and it does happen in other cases. And we often hear, oh, that's a waste of money. How many times have you heard that? Oh, it's a waste of money. There, yeah. You know, Fred West is dead. Rose West is in prison for life. What's the point?
Yeah, what purpose will be served? What purpose will be served? And yeah, it makes me so angry.
There is, if you are a parent of somebody that potentially people suspect was murdered by these people, you want to get be able to sleep a little bit better. You don't want to go to your own grave not knowing what happened to your child, or that your child was the victim of these people. And I think that's a responsibility that those of us in justice should carry for the victims.
Yeah. And I think when you look at cases, I do a lot of cases of unsolved murders. Mm. And one of the things that really stands out is the amount of unsolved murders that exist in the 1960s up until the 1990s. And the collation of missing people was very poor then. And in fact, very poorly investigated by the police. And as a direct result, of course, those people now have vanished and gone. You know, I know certainly when they started to look at the Fred and Rose West case, they spoke to the missing charity. And one of the things that they were really struggling with was finding reports that the police had actually made in relation to some of these missing girls. Mm. People were aware they disappeared. But because the police had failed to record that information correctly, you know, giving the answer, well, they've probably just gone off and moved on, or they'll come back at some stage. You know, that whole recording was so poor that as a result of that, there are an incredible amount of young women. And we talk about young women because predominantly it is young women,
yeah,
who have gone missing and never been found and undoubtedly have been murdered. I mean, the amount of missing persons cases that I believe, and I can't give you a stats, but I believe are murders.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds. And when we didn't have a proper recording system, when we didn't take missing as actually a sign of vulnerability, you know, and actually something that we should be investigating rather than simply accepting, people were taking advantage of that. And by people, I mean perpetrators, murderers, abusers. They would take advantage of the lack of safeguarding on the part of those who are meant to be responsible for safeguarding. So, yeah, I'm with you on this, Mark. I have no doubt whatsoever there are hundreds of murder victims, and therefore there are potentially hundreds of murderers who have not been brought to justice. And some of the ones that we're able to bring to justice are those where some DNA was available at the time.
Yeah.
And then because of the fact that Britain led the world, I mean, let's be proud about it. You know, the first DNA conviction in the world was here in the United Kingdom. You know, we've the DNA and the quality of technology is such now that we can look back at some of these cases, so long as, and there's a big so long as, some of the evidence has been retained.
Yes. And the police, of course, are very good at destroying or deleting information.
They are. The evidence has been destroyed. I mean, I would have thought in these days that there must be the ability to be able to scan it or save it or 3D model it, wherever it may be. But they, you know, if you can keep the original material or some of it, then potentially when the technology allows, we will be able then to look back at these and ultimately identify the perpetrators. And I think that's the danger. We don't.
The challenge for police officers, I think nowadays, obviously we understand that advances are in the future. But if you go back to the 60s and 70s, and I'm just giving a benefit of the doubt for scene to crime officers and police officers, they really didn't understand then, like we do now, that technology is advancing all the time. And there are some really great scene to crime officers in the 1980s, 70s and 80s who did have that vision and said, you know what, these things may change in the future.
Yeah.
And as a direct result of that, they kept the items that were recovered. And of course, now, you know, gone are the days where DNA had to be the size of a piece of paper. You know, you can't even see DNA now.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, I remember some cases we were dealing in the early days when the best we had was, it's typo. We've got some typo blood. That was it. Yes. That was the extent of it. Oh, he's typo. Therefore, There you go. There must be a case now. And you know, obviously, as you say, some far-sighted officers and technicians, etc., realized, okay, we might now, at this stage, we might only be able to work this out, but later down the line, they'll be able to find, you know, something that we've not been able to find, as long as we keep this material safe and secure and, of course, uncontaminated, which of course is a serious
cross-contamination injury. Is a huge, I mean, I'm dealing with a case at the moment, Nicola Payne, where cross-contamination has had a huge, huge impact in that case. And it'll be something that
so I'm even if you were sure that somebody's guilty because of what you've got, if because you've contaminated it, you that person can't get a fair trial, and that means justice won't be delivered. Well, a certain form of justice will, but I think that's the important thing, is that you've got to not just secure it and keep it safe, but you've got to avoid contamination.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Something that came out of certainly the work that you've done around grooming is the process now when missing people come back, that police officers go and speak to those people to ascertain what has taken place whilst they've been away. And of course, now we look at that and they think, well, why on earth didn't we do that before? But it actually has served a real purpose and is really valuable.
Yeah, I mean, the culture back then, and back then, I mean, like 5 dozen years ago, it feels like I'm talking about a different generation. Yes. But no, was this, if you went missing once, Mark, we would take it seriously. Authorities would take it seriously. If you went missing a second time, they'd take it less seriously. If you went missing 6 or 7 times, they wouldn't bother anymore. But actually, the more often you go missing, the greater the risk to you, the more vulnerable you are. And so we had to change the culture, and we did change the culture. But then, of course, when that person returns or is discovered or rediscovered or something, you need to be able to build their trust, you know, find somebody that they can trust, and then and be able to identify intelligence ultimately, or evidence even that will lead you in a certain direction. And but it comes down to trust. And you've got that person. If they've gone missing, it's because they don't think somebody trusts that they can trust anybody. Mm. They don't, you know, get on with family or whatever.
That was a really big issue in children's services. I remember when I first went in the control room in Guildford, and we had a children's home there, and they would phone up and say such and such has gone missing, and they would fax over a missing person's form, and it would just simply go into the missing person's tray from that children's home. Nobody did anything about it. It was just simply a process. There was no follow-up in relation to that. And of course, those people went missing for a reason. Now, it may well be that there wasn't anything being committed against them. There wasn't any offences to them. But the reality is that we know that those children who are in children's home are some of the most vulnerable children. And we know that offenders, you know, predators,
they target them. You know, one of the things that really, I've never forgotten this, back in 2011, 2012, when the issue first really arose following the prosecutions I was bringing, I found out that there were some of the care homes in the northwest of England had girls from the southeast of England in there. Mm. I thought, what's this? And of course, the reason, of course, is that accommodation in the north is cheaper. Yes. And so the authorities in Essex or South Surrey or wherever were sending their most troubled children to somewhere that was cheaper for them, but miles away from anybody that they might know, any areas they may know. And of course, the second thing that happens was when I spoke to the police forces, I said, right, do you know where all these care homes are? They said, no, confidentiality reasons, we're not told. So what? And the second thing, of course, was that the people who do you think knew where the children's care homes were? The offenders.
Of course they did.
They were parked outside them on a daily basis. So the police didn't know where they were, but the offenders did. Well, you know, this is where we were. And that's literally 10 years, not even 10 years ago. We've made strides since then. Still some way to go. But it literally goes to show how one person not talking to another person or one system not interacting with another system leaves the most vulnerable at greater risk than ever before.
Yeah, I know when I first went into child protection, I can't remember when it was. It must have been in the early 2000s. We were absolutely inundated over a period of time with allegations relating to past children's homes, that had shut down. And as a result of information that was now coming in from people who were in those homes who had grown up. And I remember it being quite a task to get local authority to allow previous documents, all the files to be recovered so that we can actually find that. And by and large, they did. But there were a number of children's homes, certainly there was at least one inquiry I did in children's home where all that documentation had disappeared and was no longer available.
Well, it was all paper, wasn't it? Now, I think pretty much everything can be digitally held. But back then, it was all pieces of paper and diaries and dictionaries and logbooks and whatever it is. And first thing they do, I guess, and I'm sure that if you're going to cover something up, the first thing I would do is burn everything. So that's what they were capable of doing, and they weren't interested in supporting you and your inquiries. They would rather pretend it never happened at all.
And of course, we know that because if you're looking to try and find documentation that exists in relation to a case that isn't present or is for years old, you know, the best way to defend that is to say it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's an awful lot of cases where files have been destroyed, burnt, got rid of, simply because they know that what's contained within those documents is compelling evidence against an offender.
Yeah, absolutely. And they won't have kept copies. If you have a situation, if you let the offenders or people who are covering up for offenders have the evidence, well, the evidence won't get very far. It won't come anywhere nearer the authorities, will it? So that's the culture we've inherited. I hope that, you know, we're now in a situation where people are much more aware. We have a whistleblowing system now where people are keen and supported if they come forward and say, look, I've seen this and I've seen that. I think we've learned a great deal from some of those terrible experiences of the past. But, you know, Fred and Rose West were able to kill 12, 20, how many? We don't know the full extent until such time as, you know, they got caught, and they would have carried on if they hadn't been caught. And we should have had a system in place that would enable us to identify them after one. Never mind after 12.
Absolutely. And of course, a shocking reminder for us of just how many unsolved missing persons cases, murder inquiries there are out there. And as a direct result of course, those being unsolved, there are a number, and we can't be clear how many, but a number, and I suspect a significant number, of killers walking amongst us.
We would encourage, wouldn't we not, if people have serious concerns that a missing person from whatever period has been harmed, that they first, of course, raise it with the police. But, of course, we would like to hear their stories too. So, you know, I think that we want to recognize that whilst we may not be in a position to do anything about it, but we certainly would love to highlight people's concerns in the hope that perhaps they can get some closure, given what's happened to their loved ones.
Absolutely. I mean, if anyone's listening to this, you know, Nazir and I are very approachable. Please, you know, if we can help in any way, then let us know, and we will obviously pass on any information that's necessary to the authorities. Nazir, another fantastic chat. You know, we say this every week. We could just continue talking forever.
We could. But for the fact that I now have to take my son to Liverpool to university. Because his Christmas break's over. I'd love to talk to you. I would prefer that, to be frank, than getting in the car with all his rubbishy, smelly stuff.
Music. I bet you have to listen to his tracks, do you?
Thankfully, he has his own headphones and listens to his own music, which gives me a bit of peace and quiet. But, you know, I don't begrudge him. I wish I was young once. Wish we were young again, wouldn't we? We'd love that opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Would I, if I said to you, Nazir, what age would you be if you wanted to start a game? What do you think was your best age?
I think in my 40s, I'll be honest with you.
40s.
I think by that time I had some real experience under my belt, and I'd made some terrible mistakes in my personal life and got through them, et cetera, et cetera. I think that would be the perfect time for me. I would hate to be in my 20s again.
Yes, I think that teenage years and the 20s, I think now would be a really difficult period of time.
Absolutely. Good luck to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, thank you for listening to Fear or Favour. Join us again next week. Hopefully you've enjoyed it. Do drop us a line. Tell your friends all about us. You can contact us via our Twitter page, or you can go to the website. Thank you for listening. Nazir, look after yourself and have another fantastic week.
You too, Mark.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.